So welcome to this week's Q&A session. I will now mute all, and everybody does have the ability to unmute themselves. Please feel free to do so if you have a question or comment. Please remute yourself after talking in order to keep our background noise to a minimum. Later this evening, a PDF of the deck presented tonight, or decks, the audio recording and the contents of the chat window will go up on our website for your perusal. And Alan, how about you lead us through tonight's deck?
Okay, thanks, Chris, and welcome everyone. We have a full agenda tonight, I think, so we'll get right going, get right started. And a question came in dealing with basically taking pictures of people and posting them on the website. And this is specific to a condominium Facebook group and whether the administrator is allowed to post photographs of people in the condo at their social activities. And she says that nothing on Google suggests it's a good idea, and it may even be illegal. And do people have to give permission? And that means written consent. And basically, is there a website that will tell you all about it? So if anybody has any clue in terms of how this all works, tell us all about it. Put something in the chat, and we'll come back to that later on. In the meantime, Chris and I have had a brief conversation about it, and you'll recognize the first statement here as a criticism. And we're not lawyers, so nothing that we can say should be held against us and may not even be correct. And so there are two links which I found on the website. The first one is quite a decent Canadian source. And if you go through the whole thing, it seems to be quite comprehensive in terms of this stuff. The second one is a U.S. lawyer, so obviously dealing with U.S. law may not be precisely applicable in Canada, but no doubt there's some good information. And I'm sure if you search, you'll find all kinds of wonderful things. And what I would suggest is looking for things like photographs, websites, and in particular, expectation of privacy. That seems to be one of the key parameters here. So the first link is from this Internet Policy and Public Interest Clinic. And they basically say that you don't really need permission to photograph people for personal photography, but for commercial activity, and I don't know how a condo group fits into that, that usually requires consent. And if you want to distribute photographs, then typically you do need consent. So posting things on the website suggests that you would have to have permission. And that's kind of echoed by this American lawyer. I love the tagline here, stay out of court and at your desk. And so the big question in her mind is, did the person have a reasonable expectation of privacy? And if you take a picture of somebody on the street, they clearly don't. But if you take a picture in a private setting, such as a home or an office or a meeting of a condominium association, then you should assume you need permission before you publish. So that's as far as I got. And again, if anybody has any better information on that, Chris and I would love to hear from you.
As a general rule, just to add a personal take on it, and again, I am not a lawyer, but I think it's, if nothing else, it's the polite thing to do to, you know, get people's permission before posting a photo. Whether it goes as far as, you know, getting an actual release signed, I mean, that to me, in a lot of cases, seems a bit overkill, but letting people know when you are taking photos that, hey, this is going to be going up. You know, it's going to be used in the following context. Let me know if you have any objection. I think that is as an absolute minimum. But again, you know, legally speaking, you may actually be required to have a release signed by anybody if you're posting these photos in any sort of public venue.
Tim says we have his permission to post pictures. So grab a screenshot and let's
there we go.
Edit it. Yeah, the other thing is, I think for things like associations, you really should have a privacy director under the Privacy and Personal Information Act, the PIPEDA, I think it's called. So if anybody complains, you should have a person who you can complain to and who will deal with it and presumably take a picture down if it wasn't really wanted. Okay, moving along, Chris has got a follow-up on last week's discussion on PDF files and different fonts.
Yeah, so last week it dealt specifically with dealing with, say, a Word document or something like that, where you have fonts that are you're using. You pass on that document to somebody else, and how does that document actually appear to that person who's receiving it if they don't have those fonts installed? So the question came up. Alan asked, well, what about if you PDF a file? And I thought, oh, that's interesting, because I hadn't really considered PDFing it. And how is it affected? And it's a little bit of a rabbit's hole. We'll go through a couple of the scenarios through here to let you know what I found out. But keep in mind that, you know, things could be a little bit different than this depending on various circumstances. So, again, it's the idea that you receive the document installed with fonts not installed on the computer, may mess up the document in a big way, and how does PDFing retain the original fonts or the appearance of the fonts. So if we look at this document, I actually have two fonts that I've used on here. So the first is Caveat, which is the font that is actually used for the new OPC UG logo for our motto portion of that. And then the Eastgood font. And I chose these for very specific reasons. Next. So the Caveat font is a free font that is probably not on most computers, but it is free, and so there shouldn't be any licensing issues with that. Eastgood, on the other hand, is a font that is almost certainly not on most computers. It is a commercial font. It is available through the Monotype MyFonts website, and it's a relatively inexpensive font, but I purchased that font. I have it installed on my computers, but if I pass on a document, it's almost certainly not on another computer. Next. So just as a recap, so what happens when you're sharing a document to a computer without fonts installed, and you can have embedding the fonts and sharing the document to a computer without the fonts installed. So what is actually going to happen next? So here's where, with no document, no fonts embedded in the document, and you pass that on the original document, you get on the computer that is creating the document, this is what it looks like. Next. And this is what it looks like on the recipient's computer that has neither of those fonts installed. So there's a font substitute that ends up happening on both of those fonts because they're not embedded into the document. Next. So what happens if you embed fonts? So if on the originating computer I go to the file menu and save, I can choose to embed fonts into the file itself. So I have both Caveat and Eastgood installed on this computer. Again, Caveat is a free font. Eastgood is not. It's a commercial font only. So if I embed those and then I pass it on next, what happens is, the Caveat font is actually displayed correctly. It was embedded in the document because there were no licensing issues. So the font was actually embedded in it. You can get that font from GitHub or Google Fonts. And then Eastgood wasn't embedded because it is a commercial font. So it is actually flagged as being non-embeddable. And so a font substitution happens on that particular document. So next. So file sizes is interesting when you start embedding fonts. And I find this pretty universal that if you embed fonts, this sort of thing happens. It's only a 12K file if you don't have fonts embedded. It balloons to a 1.6 megabyte file with embedding the fonts. And again, the only font that could be installed was Caveat. And so that one font ballooned that document to 1.6 megabytes, regardless of the fact that the Caveat font file itself is only 330K. So I don't know what's going on when you embed a font into a document, but it almost always balloons it to huge proportions. Next. So what happens when you create a PDF from that file? Next. So there are a couple of ways that you can create a PDF file. So one is save as and choose file type of PDF. And this is without having the save options to embed the font in the file. So I had that turned off, and I just did save as PDF. Notice that little section at the bottom. It says bitmap text when fonts may not be embedded. So, and it's grayed out, so it's actually going to do that automatically. So that sort of tells me that if fonts can be embedded, they're probably going to be embedded even though I didn't put it in the save options. And it also tells me that if you can't embed the font, then it's going to make a bitmap of that, so a graphic. And indeed, that's what actually happens. So when you have it, caveat is in there. It's in as text. So you can actually copy characters. You can search on them in the PDF document. You can search on the text and so forth. However, Eastgood is in there as a graphic. You cannot copy individual letters. You cannot search on text within that PDF file for Eastgood. Next. So if I take this was just curiosity, because Word has the ability to open a PDF file for editing. And if I open that PDF file in Microsoft Word, really curious, because caveat, which is a free font and was embedded in that PDF file, comes in as just plain text with a font substitute happening, but it is editable text. The Eastgood came in as a graphic. Next. So another way that you can create a PDF file natively to Windows is to print and choose as your printer Microsoft Print to PDF. This is essentially, I believe, doing exactly the same as save as a PDF format. So the file size was only about 49K, and then the PDF opened on the computer without caveat and Eastgood installed. Both fonts showed correctly. Caveat was individual text, so you could copy characters out of it. You could search on the text that is in caveat font. Eastgood was there as a graphic. You can't copy individual letters or words, and you can't search on it. So pretty much the same results as you got with the save as, except for the file size, which was kind of interesting. So I also have this program installed on my computer, PDF Creator. There's a free version, there's a paid version. I've just got the free version installed on it. So I did a print to that particular printer, and it pops up, creates it. File size was only 14K. But interestingly, opening up that on a computer without either of those two fonts installed, both fonts showed correctly. So you have that nice way that the document is presented. But in addition to that, both caveat and Eastgood were there in the PDF file as text, meaning you could copy characters, words, or sentences, or whatever out of that, and you could also search on any of that text. So if I did a search in that particular document, PDF file, on good, it would actually find it, whereas the two means of printing by Microsoft, either print a PDF or save as a PDF, you wouldn't be able to do that search. And I included the link there and to be able to download the PDF Creator free if you're interested. Next. So then I opened that PDF in Word, and interestingly, both of them came in just as plain text. So I lost all appearances of it, but they are both editable text, and so you can deal with them as you really choose. It's a little bit of an oddity opening up PDF in Word. I just thought it curious. Next. So my conclusion is that if you just want to pass on a copy of the document that displays all of the fonts correctly so they look as they looked on your computer, even if the fonts are not installed on a recipient's computer, certainly PDFing it is an option. And if you use either Microsoft Print to PDF or the Save as PDF, you will get all text rendered visually. So it'll look the same as it was on your computer. Fonts that can't be embedded are rendered as a graphic. And so for those portions, you can't select or copy text or search text. There's nothing extra to install. You'll find it on every Windows 10 computer. So it's kind of nice in that regard. If you want to be able to, the recipient of this PDF file, to be able to select, copy, and search text, no matter of what font it was actually created in, try using PDF Creator. You get all text will get rendered visually the same as it was on your computer with the fonts installed, but in addition to that, all text can be selected, copied, searched, and so forth. You have to install an extra program, but it is free. And again, the link to that is there. So that's as far as I went on it. If anybody has any other programs for creating PDF files and want to do some tests and report back on it, I think that would be really good. Again, I only use the two that are available from Microsoft, as well as that one PDF creator. So if anybody has any additions to that, that would be great. Tom asks about LibreOffice. LibreOffice actually made a mess of things. I was kind of surprised that it didn't do a better job than it did. I did one or two creating PDF files, and I gave up because I didn't find that it did a very good job. Now, there is a brand new version of LibreOffice out, so maybe the new version does something else better. Is PDF Creator GUI using a drag-and-drop files approach? PDF Creator is a printer driver, and so you just, in whatever document you've created, whether it's a PowerPoint file or a TextPad or Word or whatever, you just do file print, select PDF Creator as your printer, and then it'll pop up asking for a file name to save it to, a PDF file name, and then it'll create the PDF from that. Quite simple to use.
Yes, going back to your LibreOffice experience, was that, were the problems related to the two fonts? Because generally I find LibreOffice does a good job creating PDFs from a regular document.
Yeah, it was to do with the two fonts that were installed. And I can't remember the how bad it was, but it was definitely worse than I got doing it from Microsoft Word creating it. And I'd have to review it again, but I think that it ended up that EastGood, no matter what, it ended up doing a font substitute. It didn't look like EastGood in the end result. And I can't remember exactly what happened with Caveat, but it was actually pretty bad. I'll look at it again, but I sort of abandoned it, and I never really got back to seeing if I could figure out what was going wrong.
Yeah, they probably scrambled it because it's not an open source font.
It could be.
Okay, thanks, Chris. Well, we'll see if anybody tries anything else and gets back to us on that. Okay, so the next item is part two of my exploration of wireless printing. And you may remember that last week I had an issue where I was trying to create a wireless printer, but it basically reverted me. I followed the manual, the obvious links, but it basically sent me to use a USB cable. So the question is, this manual says that the printer has Wi-Fi protected system installed, WPS. So the question is, why didn't I get offered the opportunity to run around the house and press all kinds of WPS buttons? And well, it turns out that you should read the fine manual much more carefully, because if you ignore the obvious links and actually read down the page, eventually you come to this section which talks about using the WPS button. And basically it says you can easily configure the wireless network by pressing the WPS button. So here it gives me all the instructions if I don't have a display screen, which my printer doesn't. And basically, we won't bother with the details for the moment, but it basically says press the WPS button on the printer, all kinds of lights will blink, press WPS on the router, and then run setup, and you'll be in business. Now, well, it turns out it's a bit more complicated than that. At least the instructions are basically correct, but you have to follow a very specific sequence of operations, as I found out with multiple tries. So, first of all, you remember that on the control panel, the blue light was the WPS light, and the horizontal light at the bottom, the green light, was a status light. So if you hold the WPS button down for about 5 seconds on my particular printer, then the green status light blinks 3 times and then it goes steady. And then the blue WPS light starts to blink slowly, which is what was supposed to happen. Now, at this point, you're supposed to run around. It says, press the WPS button on the router. So in my case, the router is in a completely different room on a different floor of the house from the printer. So I've got 2 minutes. So I could go downstairs and press the magic button and then come back upstairs again. But that gets tedious when you're trying to figure out how long you have to press all these buttons for and let the thing time out 2 minutes so you can start all over again. And so I found actually there's a much easier way to do it kind of remotely. What you can do is log on to the admin panel of the router, which in my case is this IP address, and then I can actually press the WPS button, a software version of it, inside the administration panel. So here's my router's admin panel. This is a Bell router. There's an option here for WPS, and if I go there, here is where you can toggle WPS on or off as you choose. I have it on. And here is the magic button in software that I can just press this button, and it's equivalent to pressing the hardware button on the actual router. So once you start doing that, then the button starts counting down and it will run for basically 2 minutes. And at this point, the blue light on the printer, the WPS light on the printer, is blinking slowly, and it blinks for quite a while too. And eventually the blue light's supposed to blink rapidly. Now, strange but true. Some of the times when I did this, what happened was the router came back to me and said, WPS failed to connect. So I started all over again. But eventually I figured out, I just waited. And even though it says WPS failed to connect, eventually the WPS light on the printer did start to blink rapidly, which is what it's supposed to do. Because once it does that, then the WPS light goes solid. And now you know that the printer and the router are actually talking to each other. So it really is a crapshoot in terms of when you press buttons and when you watch lights and what you do. It seems to be a trial and error operation, which I think is why Chris found wireless printers so frustrating in the first place.
I think so.
Anyway, we've now got the printer and the router talking to each other, seeing each other. You remember the next instruction was to run setup, and we did this last week using the cable connection, but it's basically the same thing. We choose a wireless connection, say, yes, I want to set up the printer, and use direct wireless. And then it goes off and it looks for the, actually it doesn't. The first thing it does is it comes back and tells me, all right, now press the WPS button on the printer. So I did that. That's pressing the hardware button on the actual printer now. Now it goes off and looks for the settings and things. And eventually it says network setting complete. So it's now happy. And now, interestingly enough, even though last week I had installed all the software because I did this through the cable, now it's still offering to install all the same software. And worse than that, if I say, no, I don't want to install any software, then it doesn't create the wireless connection for me. So I have to install something. So I basically just installed the first one, which was the printer driver. So I reinstalled the printer driver, and then it was completely happy. Setup is now completed. I can turn on the Eco driver, printer test page, and bingo. I have a wireless printer connection made through my WPS buttons all over the place. So there we go. That's my experience with one wireless printer, and it kind of mirrors Chris's experience in terms of wireless printers are incredibly complicated and frustrating and not all that well documented.
Yeah, the other thing that I found frustrating about wireless printers is that occasionally it just seemed to magically vanish the connection, and yeah, it might have to power the printer on and off and, you know, things like that. It's just it wasn't as stable a connection as a wired connection, and I just found it frustrating that when things go away, and they never go away if I'm connected by a cable.
Yeah, the only problem I have with a cable is I don't have enough USB ports on this laptop.
Ah,
so
yeah.
I only plug the printer in when I want to print. And of course, what I do is I go into LibreOffice, I say print, and then nothing happens and I can't figure out why. And it's because I haven't plugged the printer in. Anyway, there we go. So now we've got a question about passwords in the browser, and Chris is going to comment on this.
Yeah, okay, the question came in by email to suggestionbox@opcug.ca. Hint, hint, if anybody has anything, they can send it in there. We will attempt to find an answer to your questions, or and if not, we'll just put the question into slides and bring it up with everybody on the call. Or if you have something you want to share, same email address to send it to, and we'll be happy to accept your slides or create your slides from your content. So the question came in saying that I'd seen more and more sites want to save, in quotes, my username and password info and even credit card info. How safe is this? And I broke this into two things because they really are completely separate things, and your username and password and your credit card info, I believe, are completely discrete things and should be looked at as separate entities. So next. So let's look at the credit card info one first off. Before I get too deep into all of this, I'm going to reiterate something I say periodically about computer security. There is no such thing as perfect computer security. I once heard that the only completely secure computer is encased in concrete, dropped in the middle of the ocean, and even then the person wasn't exactly positive. It is almost always going to be a trade-off between convenience and security. The more convenient something is, probably the less convenient it is to use. The less convenient it is, the more secure it is. So you have to find the balance that will work best for you. So looking at credit card info, if you think about, you go to a website and you're buying things. If you've ever given them your credit card, they've probably stored it anyways. Even if you didn't get to the point where they said, oh, do you want your credit card information stored? They probably stored it anyways. Okay, they have it so that they can process this payment and so forth. So any breach of that particular site could result in your card being compromised. Now, I think it is more likely if you've allowed them to store the credit card info, if you actually check that box that said, yeah, store my information, because then it's more likely to be in your profile that is accessible easily from the web. And so if your account gets compromised on there, they may have access to your credit card information depending on how it's stored and how easily the site gives up the information once you're logged in as you. Another thing to consider is limited liability. So in Canada, the maximum liability you can have is $50 on your credit card. Okay, and if you report it to the credit card company that, you've lost your card or something like that, liability ends at that point in time. So any pain or any charges that go on after that, you're not liable at all. So, maybe it's not that big a deal. Next. But think about if you don't have them store it, then you have to provide it every time you want to go and shop at that particular website. So it's going to be less convenient for you, but it probably is a little bit more secure, less likely to be compromised, but it depends on the site, and to a certain extent, I'm guessing here. So if your log on to that site is somehow compromised, then if you didn't tell them, save my credit card, then almost all certainty, just the log on to your site is not going to provide access to the attacker to your credit card information. So there's some benefits to not allowing the company to actually store it. Next. So my recommendation would be to don't have that option checked when they say, do you want us to save your credit card information to the site? Don't check that box. It is a minor inconvenience, okay? Again, inconvenience versus more security. So is it really that much trouble to have to enter your credit card information into the site every time that you want to buy something? You're less likely to have a compromised card. If you find it is too much trouble, go ahead. Tell them to save your credit card information on the site. It will make it faster and easier for you to buy stuff on that particular site with somewhat of an increased risk. I think probably not a huge increase in risk. I mean, this is not something that is you know, nobody has done before, right? There are billions of people who are saving credit card information on e-commerce sites. And, you know, is there some compromises that happen? Yeah. Is it a huge number that are compromised? Probably not. If, what is the liability? Limited to $50. You know, I mean, you have to make that balance judgment yourself. So next. Now let's work on the save password. Okay, because the saving of the password, your login ID and your password is typically the browser based rather than the site you're connecting to. So all the browsers that are out there, they will have this pop up whenever you log into a site and they'll say, do you want me to save your login credentials? And it gets saved within the browser itself. And it makes it simple to use any websites that require a password because it'll log you in automatically when you go to that particular website. So again, more convenient. So the save passwords, there is password protection built into the vaults that are built into the browsers themselves. Generally speaking, and I've only checked on a couple of browsers, I use Chrome and I know this to be the case with Chrome, if you try to look up what is a save password in there before Chrome will cough that up to you, you actually have to authenticate some other way, and typically it's the Windows password. Next. So in Chrome, this is the way you get it. You go to Settings, Autofill, and then there's a Save Password section. Next. And if you click on the eyeball to actually show a password, it will pop up and ask you to provide your credentials logging into Windows itself. So it's just not going to give it up if you happen to go off for lunch and you leave your computer open and somebody sees the browser open and they get all your passwords. Not going to happen unless they know your Windows password. Next. And that's the question. Is it safe? You know, do you have a weak or no Windows password? I know some people, they have no password on Windows so that when they fire up their computer, it comes to the desktop and all the rest of it. If you have that, then it's particularly dangerous for you to save your passwords in the browser, because if you go away and somebody comes along and finds your computer unlocked, they could get all your saved passwords. So also consider, have you given your Windows password to somebody else so that they can log on to your computer to use it for whatever purpose that you want to let them use it for? Now, browsers should, and I know this is the case with Chrome, but you can also have protection available where you can actually lock the browser profile with a different password. And so that, in that case, if somebody has your Windows password, it's not going to necessarily compromise your passwords that are stored in the browser. So consider whether you want to add that in.
Tim just put a comment in just before you talked about locking the browser. He says it's the same with Microsoft Edge. So I think that was related to a vault in the browser.
Yeah, I suspect that anything that is built on the Chromium engine probably uses the same password vault capabilities and things like that. But I think everybody, if you're using this save to the browser, save passwords to the browser, it behooves you to check to see how can they be exposed. You know, how can I go in the configuration and check what my saved passwords are and what do I need to provide in order to expose those saved passwords? Everybody should look at that if you're using that particular functionality. So next. So another question, is it good enough for low-value websites? I play games at Pogo, you know, Pogo.com. I have to log in to Pogo.com to keep my progress. They don't have my credit card. If somebody compromises that, who cares? I can create a new account at Pogo.com. So for a low-value website, you know, news info site is another one. New York Times requires me to have, you know, a New York Times website username and password in order to get 5 articles a month. So they don't have my credit card information. They don't have anything sensitive about me. They don't have my birth date or my age or, you know, my social insurance number or anything like that at all. So it's, for me, I think it's good enough. My bank site? Absolutely not, I think. You know, I say there, maybe not, but hey, that's your call again. For me, I absolutely do not save my password in the browser for my bank site. I have to look that up if I don't remember it. Next. So my recommendation on that is use the password vault. And I highly recommend, and Alan uses it as well, KeePass. It's free, open source, highly vetted. It's updated very frequently. It's been around for about 13 years, very trusted. And it allows you to keep all of your passwords in one encrypted database. And you need one, which you make very strong, your password to get into the password vault. And then it opens up all of the capability, all of the things inside. So it's certainly more secure than saving your passwords in the browser. I think that's a given. How much more secure? Well, again, that's your call. And most password vaults can be configured to log you into websites automatically or semi-automatically. And so still keeping your login convenient on your websites. Next. So always make sure, just as a reminder, use good password habits. On the Q&A from last May 5th, I had a slide on World Password Day, and it highlighted the things that you should think of for good, secure passwords. Think passphrases, not passwords, so longer, three or more words strung together, at least 12 characters long, not a common phrase or a keyboard pattern. You know, QAZWSXEDC is not a good password. Unique passwords for every service or site. And Password Keeper makes it really easy for you to adhere to that. Again, a very low value website. Maybe you could share a password between those if it's compromised, if you really don't care. If an account gets compromised, it'll compromise other accounts. All those low value ones, if you really wanted to, okay. But I don't think it's really difficult to have even unique passwords, even on the low value sites. Use Password Manager, again, KeePass, and I pasted in that into the chat. And think about digital inheritance. What's going to happen to all your passwords and your logins to these various sites if you are incapacitated or dead? And are they going to die with you, or are you going to allow somebody to access those in the event that they need to? And that's all I have on it.
Now, Thomas put a comment in here that a Windows password should be 21 plus characters, but he says, otherwise, if there is physical access, i.e. somebody can access your computer, then rainbow tables can decipher a less strong password, I guess.
Yeah. Again, I think that this is trade-off of convenience and security. Personally, I think that if you end up with something that is 12 characters, complex password, passphrase, not a password, three or more words, all the rest of it, I think that you're pretty good. Now, yes, physical access. I've always heard that, and this is one of the immutable security laws from Microsoft that dates back about 15 years. If somebody has physical access to your device, all bets are off. So it's they state it as if somebody has physical access to the device, it's not your computer anymore. So consider that in the, you know, the extreme sense.
And Stuart's reminding us that today's hysterical data breach is the Plex website, if you care.
Interesting.
I saw that one too. I'm not sure what a Plex website is, but there we go. Okay, it's time to go to Bob Walker, and Bob's got part two of his Everything You Wanted to Know About iTunes, and following up from last week. So, Bob, you're going to share your screen.
Yeah, here we go. And let me get the there we go. Okay, so in the last session, we had a look at the history of iTunes and the evolution of digital music. And iTunes itself was fairly revolutionary at the time. So in this session, I'm going to have a quick look at the basics of using the iTunes app and the iTunes store to buy music and to access your online library of digital music. And we'll also have a quick look at some alternatives to iTunes. Now, the term iTunes is used in several ways by Apple and many other people, besides for the iTunes app and the iTunes store. So it can be pretty confusing sometimes. The iTunes app itself acts as a media player, a media library, as a client app for the iTunes store, as an online radio portal, and as a portal to the Apple Music music audio and video streaming service. It can be used to purchase, play, download, and organize your digital multimedia stuff on personal computers running Windows and on older or pre-2019 versions of the Mac OS operating systems. And as we covered last session, the newer versions of the Mac OS have split iTunes into four or five separate entities. Among several other things, iTunes can even be used to rip songs from CDs and to make or burn CDs and DVDs. So it's quite a flexible application. Now, Apple has expanded on the core music features with iTunes, with support for movies, videos, TV shows, podcasts, ebooks, and more. And just a note that while most of the downloadable music from the iTunes store is digital rights management or copy protection free, most of the other downloadable content is not. Let's see. Okay. Did a bit of a double click there. Historically, the iTunes app has been downloaded and updated directly from Apple. However, recently Apple changed that, and they now want you to download the iTunes app and updates from the Microsoft Store. You can download the app at the URL given there, and if for whatever reasons you don't want to use the Microsoft Store, you can try the other URL that I gave here. So if you download the deck later on, all this information is available, and Chris will probably be pasting all the URLs that I give tonight into the chat.
Yeah, they're all there.
Yeah. Either way, the iTunes app is free to download and to use, so you don't have to pay any money or get a license for it. Now, for more on why you should or should not use the Microsoft Store, I gave the URL for an article here on Avoid iTunes Bloat with a Microsoft Store version. And in a future session, I may cover the various pros and cons of using the Microsoft Store for this and other purposes. Note that the Microsoft Store version is only good for Windows 10 and 11. If you're running older versions of Windows like 7 or 8, you'll need to download and install the Apple version. When you first install iTunes, you'll set up an iTunes account with a username, password, and payment info. You can leave out the payment info, but in this case, every time you try and buy something, you'll be prompted for it whenever you want to buy a song, album, movie, or whatever. You start the iTunes app like any other Windows app by using the Start menu, the desktop icon, or you can pin it to your taskbar. And when you start up iTunes, it'll show the screen for whatever you were doing last, whether it was the store, your library, the radio portal, or whatever. You can easily switch to the other screens using the menu in the center top of each screen. Now we're going to have a look at the the store start page here, the big thing is it has a search bar in the upper right corner, so you can go directly to whatever artist, album, or song you're after. You don't have to scroll through the page and whatever. Most of the stuff you see on the opening page for the store is all sorts of deals, offers, and links. So if you want to go through those, that's great. But if you want to get right to what you're after, use the search bar. So we're going to use the search bar to look for music by a particular artist. Now, in the past couple of sessions, I've used the group Toto as an example for a few things. So I'll carry that through using them as an example this time around. Okay, so when you search for a particular artist, iTunes will take you to the artist page. And on that page, it's similar to the page for a song. If you search just for a song, you'll get the songs page. So in this case, at the artist page, at the top of the page, there's a list of 10 songs. Each song listing has a number, the song's name, the artist, the album, the time or the length of the song, the relative popularity within iTunes, and the price to buy that song. If you hover over the number and click on it, iTunes will play a part of that song so you can make sure it's the song you're after. If you click on the price, you can buy the song, and it will be downloaded to, well, you see the directory information there. And the important part is it'll be under the artist's name directory, and within that, the album name, and within that, the songs. And the songs will normally be in the Apple lossless or the M4A format. Note that the first time in any iTunes session you click on the price, you'll be asked for your username and password just for security. It used to be that that was sort of in, and whenever you logged into iTunes, it was a given. But now they asked for this each session. And you can choose defaults as to whether you want it to ask for again and again each song you try and or album you try and buy, or whether you want it to, if you haven't bought anything for 15 minutes, or whether to not ask you ever again during the session. If you click on the album name within the song list, it'll take you to the page for that album. Now, to the right of the songs list, there's a menu, and if you click on songs in that menu, it'll expand the songs list to anywhere up to 100 songs or more, but a lot of these songs won't be from your chosen artist. It'll be similar songs, similar genres, whatever. If you click on the down arrow in the at the right of the price box, you'll be given a menu of other actions related to the songs besides buying it. And you can give the song to somebody else. You can add to your wish list, et cetera, et cetera. Now, if you scroll down a bit more on the artist page, you'll come to the albums by the artist. And if you click on the see all at the very right, it'll scroll to the right and take you to other albums. If some artists have many albums, and some not so much. And the same goes for the next line down, which is music videos by the artist. And you'll find quite often a lot of these music videos will be for other artists as well. If you scroll further down the artist page, It'll be a lot of stuff not specifically related to the particular artist you're looking at. Now, if you go to the album page, if you click on the album name or you search for an album, you'll come to the album page. And this page has the cover art for the album, a purchase box to either buy the entire album, or in the song list, you can buy each particular song. You don't have to buy the entire album. You can buy whatever songs you want off of the album. And in this case, there'll be an individual song price, which will be a bit higher than if you buy it as part of the album. Occasionally, you'll get songs that you can only get if you buy the whole album. They're special for in that edition of the album. If you buy a couple of songs and you come back later to buy the rest of the album, the cost of the songs you've already bought is deducted from the album price. And in the example here, I've already purchased four songs, so it will cost me only $6.54 to complete the album of 30 songs. And as you can see in the yellow circled area there, the regular price of this album, if I hadn't bought the songs previously, would be $12.99. Many of the songs and albums available through iTunes have been remastered from the original tapes, and they've been digitally cleaned up and enhanced. So you're getting better quality than you would get if you had the original. And some of the album pages also have ratings, reviews, and stories on the album to give you some more information. Now, the iTunes library, it keeps track of all the songs, albums, and any other digital media you've acquired from iTunes. And you can also upload any of your own music, you know, stuff you've got from CDs or from other sources, to your iTunes library. It supports importing digital audio tracks, so you can use iTunes as a music management app. As I covered a few sessions ago, music management apps are great to keep track of all your music and do searches and everything else, but it requires a fairly substantial investment in time to learn how to use the app to get the most value out of it. Now, although most media is downloaded when you purchase it, the library also keeps track of it all in your online account. So you can download it again and again and again, or you can just play it in the iTunes app whenever you want. You don't have to download it. You just click on it in the app, and it'll play for you. And iTunes supports Wave, AAFE, Apple Lossless, or M4A, AAC, MP3, and several other audio formats. So you can do a lot with it. Okay, and in the library view, the default view is by artist. And when you click on the artist in the column in the to the left of the middle of the page here, the songs are arranged by album on the right part of the screen. Now, note here, I've pointed out as number one the view menu, and this is the different views you can get of the library. And number two, within the artist's directory here, the very first thing is compilations, and we'll discuss this in just a second. When you right-click on the album title or on a song under the album title, a menu pops up with the selections you can make. You can download, you can add the song or the album to a playlist, you can play the album, you can have it shuffle play with other things, and a lot of other information of things you can do. The view menu in the upper right of the library screen allows you to choose which view of the library you want. And in this case, we're going to take a look at a quick look at the albums view. The albums view shows the album covers by artist, and then within each artist, if you have more than one album, the albums will be listed alphabetically. The albums will show up in this view even if you've only bought one song from the album, because iTunes lists all the songs by artist and then by album. That's their way of organizing things. When you click on an album within the album view list, the cover expands and the songs are listed beside it. If you right-click on the album name or on any of the song selections, a little menu will pop up with the different selections you can make. Now, after you've downloaded music from iTunes, you'll generally want to eventually move anything you download from the iTunes download directory to whatever directory structure you have your music collection in, unless you've decided you're going to let iTunes be your music management app. If that's the case, when you move them around, you may want to rename the song files to a standard format, like artist name, song title, album name, where you got it from, just to make it consistent with the other content in your music library. Once you have your downloads squared away in your music collection and backed up, you can delete it from the download directory. And don't forget, iTunes keeps copies of all the stuff you bought off them in your account on the web, so you can download it again or you can play it directly from iTunes. So if you clear out your download directory, you're not going to lose your stuff. Now, iTunes has a few little quirks. The quirk number one we're going to look at is compilations. iTunes normally downloads songs into your iTunes music directory by artist, album, and then the songs, or it lists it in the library by artist. However, if the song is a greatest hits type of albums, even if it's specific to a particular artist, they place it in iTunes Media Music Compilations album and then song, not by artist album and then song. Now, the compilations directory would normally be for true compilations, which is an album that has several artists on it, and that's what the compilations section is for, but in this case, it can be a little bit confusing. Especially if the album title is something like just Greatest Hits, without mentioning the artist names. Quite often it's Greatest Hits of the Birds or something like that, but if it just says Greatest Hits, you sort of look at it in the compilations directory there, so whose Greatest Hits? You may actually have to go in and play one of the songs to check out the tag to figure out who the artist is, because you can have several Greatest Hits albums in that directory. So if you go to look in your iTunes library for music by a particular artist, it may not be listed under the artist name, but in the compilations section instead. And this can get further complicated if you have a greatest hits by that artist and several other albums by that artist. So it can be a little bit confusing. But if you know about it in advance, you can avoid any problems. Secondly, they have a little quirk about soundtracks. You would think that iTunes would hold soundtracks in your library and download it as a soundtrack album that you buy as the album from that movie, but sometimes they don't. They somehow think it is better to hold and to download the songs from a soundtrack album under each individual composer's or performer's name instead. Thus, the songs may be split up among three or four entities. And once you download them, it is up to you to put them all back together again in a single directory on your computer or smartphone for that soundtrack, so you can play all of the songs from the soundtrack in the correct order. For example, in the album view below, you can see there's three instances of the soundtrack for the movie The Revenant. It's not a particularly good soundtrack, but anyway. In one instance, the music was composed by Ryuichi Sakamoto. In the next instance, the music was composed by Ryuichi Sakamoto and Elva Noto. And in the last instance, music was composed by Ryuichi Sakamoto, Elva Noto, and Bryce Dessner. So if you click on any one of these album covers, you can only play a section of the songs from that soundtrack. And then we have another little quirk with iTunes. Some albums have a deluxe edition version as well as the originally released version. In the deluxe edition, they may have additional songs or maybe two or more versions of a particular song. So when you buy the deluxe edition album, iTunes may download the songs on the original album to a directory for the original album and download the deluxe edition special songs to a separate directory for the deluxe edition album. So it sort of splits them up on you. Likewise, if you only buy some of the songs that were on the original album will download into a directory for the original album, and the deluxe edition special songs will download into a separate directory for the deluxe edition album. It can be a little bit frustrating sometimes when you're searching for something. Just a note here about the song tags in iTunes. As much as the three quirks mentioned can cause issues in the way the songs are tagged, other than that, the tagging of songs downloaded from
Bob, if you can hear me, we've lost your audio.
I think we've lost Bob.
It could be. Oh,
there we are.
Hello?
Bob, you back?
Yeah. Where did you lose me?
Pretty much at the, I think we covered that slide.
Okay. I was just saying the sound quality from iTunes is very consistent and the sound levels are consistent. If you've downloaded a bunch of songs from iTunes, you'll get some are very good quality. Some of the quality is very, very bad. Likewise, you'll be playing one song in your car, for example. You have to turn up the volume and turn up the volume and turn up the volume to hear it. And then the next song will come on and blow you out of your seat. So iTunes is great to get consistency and good quality amongst the songs in your library. Now, some of what we've covered can be changed if you dig down deep enough into the various settings. The iTunes can do a lot more than I've covered here. And if you want to explore this further and perhaps use iTunes as your music management app, you can start with the Big Book of iTunes. This is a free download PDF. It's a starter guide for iTunes. There's also the complete guide to using the iTunes, in the iTunes Store. There's some additional information on the iTunes Store on Wikipedia. Now, if you want to try some other online music stores, Wikipedia has their comparison of digital music stores at the URL listed. If you want to try streaming music that you want to play at any given time instead of buying it, Wikipedia also has a comparison of music streaming services at the URL listed. And keep in mind that some of the music streaming services, if you have a deluxe subscription package, also allow you to sort of buy or download the songs if you want. So you can get sort of the best of both worlds in that case. I've got the list of all the URLs I've mentioned so far in this presentation, and I believe Chris will probably paste it into the chat.
Yep, they're all in the chat.
Okay, great. And that's it for tonight. Let me stop the share here and turn it back to Alan and Chris.
Okay, thanks, Bob. And just two things to finish up. Just a reminder that our members' favorites night will be on September the 14th. So if you have anything that you want to share, just send a heads up to suggestion box and we'll be sure to reserve a slot. And as I said previously, we're open to anything computer related. So your choice. And finally, next week, next Wednesday, August 31st, will be our next Q&A session. So again, if you have any questions that you desperately need an answer for, or new topics that you'd like to share with the group, then send those to the same place and we'll reserve a slot for you next week. And after that, that's it for me. And good night, everyone. Hope you enjoyed it.
Thanks, folks. We'll see you next week.